Welcome to Nice News. This is a broadcast about some unusual topics. I'm Joyce Vesper, your Sun Sounds of Arizona volunteer broadcaster. On Nice News, we cover information from all over the world on many different topics. The program provides a time out from the daily news that doesn't always cover the happiest of information. So please, give us a listen. Who knows what might give you a smile or cause you to remember something from another era or pop your interest, such as this article by Ella Feldman. This Inca building, the only surviving structure of its kind, might have been designed to amplify sound and music. The Peruvian town of Huatara is home to the 15th century Inca building that's usually simple for the civilization, which is known for its intricate architecture, like the structure seen at Machu Picchu. This building, in contrast, consists of three stone walls and an opening. Now, researchers think that they've discovered the reason for the design. The Inca may have built the structure with the express purpose of amplifying sound and music. We're learning that sound was incredibly important from the earliest cities on, dating back several thousand years, says Stella Nair, an art historian at the University of California, Los Angeles. Builders were incredibly sophisticated with their oral architecture, and the Incas are one part of this long, sophisticated tradition of sonic engineering. The building is known as Carpa Uasi, or tent house, a name that references its open-ended structure. It's the only known surviving Carpa Huasi, as these constructions weren't as structurally sound. The structure survives today for a somewhat ironic reason. Spanish colonizers ordered that the Church of San Juan Bautista be built on top of the Carpa Huasi in the 16th century. That was meant to override Inca cultural heritage. The church ended up providing the building with the stability it needed to endure for centuries. Nair and her colleagues, a team of acoustic experts led by Stanford University's Jonathan Berger, believed that the structure was designed to amplify sound by funneling it to one end, creating a natural speaker of sorts. The Inca might have used the Carpa Huasi to project low-frequency sounds like drums announcing the end of a battle. In her 2015 book, At Home with the Sapa Inca, Architecture, Space, and Legacy at Chinchero, Nair noted that the Carpa Huasi walls aren't placed at right angles. Instead, the open end is wider than the closed one, creating a trapezoidal shape. This subtle widening of the structure at the open end allowed for greater visibility between the people inside and those outside the building. It was a helpful design choice if the structure was used as a gathering place. Over the course of 3 weeks in the remote town of Huatara, Nair and her colleagues studied the Carpa Huasi, a distinct architecture, taking measurements and photographs and creating drawings. Next, the researchers used 3D modeling to approximate what the structural original roof looked like, and they generated a model of how sound would have traveled through the building. Many people look at Inca architecture and are impressed with the stonework, but that's just the tip of the iceberg, says Nair, who studies indigenous art and is working on her third book about Andean architecture. They were also concerned about the ephemeral, temporary, and a permanent sound was one of those things. Sound was deeply valued and an incredible, important part of Andean and Inca architecture. So much so that the builders allowed some instability in the structure just because of its acoustic potential. At its height, the Inca Empire was the largest empire in pre-Columbian America. By the time the Spanish colonizers arrived in the early 16th century, the empire encompassed modern-day Peru, most of Chile, and swaths of Ecuador, Colombia, Bolivia, and Argentina. The Inca valued the arts and viewed architecture as the most important of them all. What the Incas did that was really smart is, rather than trying to make an architecture that alone is going to be impressive, Nair tells histories.com Tom Metlaff, they instead made an architecture that was in dialogue with the vast, impressive landscape. Because the Inca left behind such a wealth of complex, visually interesting structures, Nair says academics have sometimes overemphasized the visual art in their scholarship about the empire. Sound studies are really critical because we tend to emphasize the visual in how we understand the world around us, including our past, Nair says in the UCLA statement, but that's not how we experience life. All of our senses are critical. So how we understand ourselves and our history changes if you put sound back into the conversation. Ella Feldman wrote, "This Inca building, the only surviving structure of its kind, might have been designed to amplify sound and music." Our next article, "Walking a few thousand steps a day may reduce Alzheimer's risk," Dana G. Smith writes the article. Walking a few thousand steps a day can slow cognitive decline in older adults who are at increased risk of developing Alzheimer's disease. That's according to the research published Monday. Getting about 3,000 to 5,000 daily steps was advantageous compared with doing less physical activity. The benefit peaked around 5,000 to 7,500 steps. The link between exercise and dementia is well established, and many neurologists say physical activity is one of the best ways to reduce the odds of developing the condition. The new study, published in the journal Natural Medicine, sheds light on what might be playing out in the brain and who could benefit most from exercise. We've known for several decades that physical activity is associated with the reduced risk of developing dementia, said Kirk Erickson, chair of the neuroscience at the Advent Health Research Institute, who was not involved with the research. What the new study has done that is really quite important and really unique, he said, is to identify how exercise might be influencing some of the proteins implicated in the Alzheimer's disease. The study followed nearly 300 older adults between ages 50 and 90 for an average of 9 years. None of the participants had cognitive impairment at the start of the study, and about 30% had considerable buildup of the protein amyloid beta in their brains. The amyloid buildup, often referred to as plaque, is a hallmark of Alzheimer's, but prior research has shown that roughly 10% of 50-year-olds and 44% of 90-year-olds have amyloid plaque without signs of cognitive impairment. What differentiates those people from people that do develop cognitive decline over time? Said Dr. Jasmir Chhatwal, a neurologist at Massachusetts General Hospital who led the research, "We want to find baseline characteristics that predict that." When the participants enrolled in the study, they received a pedometer that they wore for a week. That was to establish their average daily step count. They underwent cognitive testing annually and PET scans every few years to look for amyloid plaque and the accumulation of another protein related to Alzheimer's called tau. Researchers think that in Alzheimer's disease, amyloid builds up first and that triggers so-called tangles of tau to form inside neurons and spread through the brain. It is primarily those tangles, not the amyloid plaque, that cause brain cells to malfunction, resulting in cognitive impairment. The number of steps someone took each day didn't appear to affect their amyloid levels, but it did correlate with the amount of tau tangles that developed and if they experienced cognitive decline. Among the participants with more amyloid in their brains, those who got little to no physical activity developed more tangles and had worse cognition after 9 years. Walking 3,001 to 5,000 steps a day corresponds to less tau accumulation and slower cognitive decline. People who took more than 5,000 steps a day fared far better. Getting more than 7,500 steps did not confer an additional benefit. People with minimal amounts of amyloid in their brain did not see any changes in either tau or cognition related to their step count. Dr. Chhatwal said that may be because those individuals were unlikely to experience significant tau buildup or cognitive decline since they didn't have levels that were high enough of the amyloid to begin with. Dr. Erickson cautioned that these are observational, so it's possible that another factor explains the connection between physical activity, cognition, and tau. What's more, because the participants only wore a pedometer for 1 week at the beginning of the study, their daily step counts could have increased or decreased over the years. Judy Pa, a professor of neuroscience at the University of California in San Diego, called the new research fascinating. But she pointed out that the study included a relatively small number of participants, most of whom were white and well-educated. Can we replicate it in a multi-ethnic cohort, she asks. The number of steps needed to see a benefit is consistent with other research on the physical activity in older adults, said Amanda Pollock, an associate professor of kinesiology at the University of Massachusetts in Amherst, who was not involved in the new study. In research she conducted, older adults had a lower risk of dying from multiple different causes if they got roughly 6,000 steps per day. One way physical activity may protect against cognitive decline is by increasing blood flow to the brain. That keeps neurons oxygenated and nourished so that they can function optimally. Improved vascular health can also help the brain rid itself of the toxic proteins that accumulate. Exercise reduces inflammation in the brain too, and inflammation is closely linked to Alzheimer's disease. Virtually everyone who exercises will experience these brain benefits to some degree, but the new research suggests that people who are at the greatest risk of cognitive decline may stand to gain the most. People with pre-existing amyloid plaque can see an acceleration of the disease progression if they're sedentary, said Dr. Chatterwal. But the good news is that even kind of moderate levels of activity are productive. Dana G. Smith wrote this article, "Walking a Few Thousand Steps a Day May Reduce Alzheimer's Risk." Our next article, New York City's first free food vending machine brings fresh meals to those in need. For many of us, vending machines have long been a familiar sight on college campuses, in waiting rooms and workplace lounges, offering quick snacks like chocolate bars and sodas. However, a wonderful transformation is happening. These machines are evolving into valuable resources for communities, providing essential items like hygiene products, pregnancy tests, and even life-saving Narcan. In the Bronx, New York, the nonprofit Change Food for Good is embracing this innovative approach by introducing its very first free food vending machine at Kipps Bay Boys and Girls Club. This initiative is not just about convenience. It's about ensuring that everyone has access to nourishing food. According to their social media announcement, the vending machine will be filled with quality grocery items such as eggs, fruit, and vegetables once or twice a month. Many of these offerings are sourced from local vendors and cooperatives, promoting community support and sustainability. The produce is available in these machines, and it is often grown through Change Food for Good's hydroponic gardening program, which engages local youth in learning and cultivating fresh food. The process is simple and user-friendly. Just approach the machine, pick an item, and it will vend with ease. After successfully distributing over 15,500 pounds of free food to more than 1,100 families in New York City, the organization is excited about the new distribution model that aims to provide good food when it's needed most. There's even a QR code for community members to suggest additional food items that they would like to see in the machine. Although some popular choices, like milk and plantains, might require special arrangements due to space constraints. Each item will be carefully labeled with dates to ensure food safety, and organizers have taken extra precautions to keep items secure during the vending process. For example, garlic is vacuum sealed to prevent its distinct aroma from spreading to other goods, showcasing the thoughtful planning behind this initiative. As founder Samia Lemfadli shared, the machine's design ensures that items bend slowly, taking about 15 seconds so the delicate items like eggs can land safely in their carriers. This thoughtful approach also claims to encourage users to take only what they truly need. Importantly, there are no restrictions on who can access the vending machine. The Change Food for Good team invites others in the community to replicate their model, emphasizing that with the rising grocery prices, this initiative can provide vital support to families in need. They hope that other changemakers and organizations will be inspired to set up similar free food vending machines in schools, hospitals, and other community spaces. While they recognize that no solution is perfect in addressing food insecurity, the team is committed to continuously improving the system to ensure that everyone has the access to nutritious options. As Lemfadli stated, one of the main goals of the Good Food for All program is to ensure that individuals, even if they're struggling, still have their dignity and agency preserved through food choice. This initiative is all about empowerment, allowing individuals such as single parents to easily access what they need without stigma or barriers. If you're in the Bronx area, you can visit the vending machine at Kipps Bay Boys and Girls Club, located at 625 Castle Hill Avenue. And for those who wish to support this inspiring effort, donations can be made online. The initiative not only addresses food access, but also fosters a sense of community and hope, reminding us all of the goodness that comes from caring for one another. This article, New York City's First Free Food Vending Machine Brings Fresh Meals to Those in Need. Our next article, written by Stephanie Friedman, Teen's award-winning robot turtle could help underwater ecosystems thrive by detecting threats. It's shaped like a turtle and swims like a turtle, but it's actually a bionic robot. Evan Buds, a 15-year-old resident of Ontario, Canada, recently won a first-place prize in the European Union contest for Young Scientists 2025. That was for his invention of an autonomous bionic sea turtle robot. The adorable device was developed to monitor and detect threats in underwater ecosystems, such as coral bleaching and invasive species. It uses an AI computer vision imaging system and can evaluate coral health with 96% accuracy. Evan told CBC News he hopes that the bot will empower organizations to identify where these threats may be occurring, increasing awareness and supporting efforts to increase the overall health of impacted areas. But why the turtle-like design? Evan said in a YouTube video that he was inspired after witnessing the fluent motion of a snapping turtle while camping. Instead of designing a traditional propeller-based system, Evan saw potential in a different type that mimicked turtle movement. So that's what he built. First, he analyzed the movements of wild green sea turtles, which exhibit a multitude of ideal characteristics for the next generation of revolutionary biomimetic robots, he wrote in his project description. He noted that the marine creatures can migrate thousands of miles. Then he custom designed a propulsion system using servo motors along with 3D printed front and rear flippers that he tested in his grandparents' backyard pool. My propulsion exposure and approach for the robot closely imitates the unique maneuverability exhibited by the green sea turtles, which are then optimized for efficiency using computational fluid dynamic simulations and extensive underwater testing, Evan said in a video. And aside from the fluidity of his robot's movements, the design offers another critical benefit. It very minimally interferes with the underwater ecosystems Evan's working to protect. For the test, he 3D printed models of coral in a variety of colors to ensure the robot could accurately detect healthy versus bleached types. The 96% result, he told CBC News, results in and demonstrates promise for how it's going to be able to detect these different threats in a real-world environment before they are able to significantly impact the ecosystem and cause detrimental damage. From September 15th to the 20th, Evan and his peers convened in Riga, Latvia, for the 36th edition of the contest, where the first place winners were announced and received $8,200. And he's not stopping here. In the future, he aims to make improvements to the robot that would allow for water sample collection to find microplastics and other pollutants, and he wants to test the device in natural bodies of water. The need to continually assess the world's waterways is scientifically pertinent given that their biodiversity and vital role that they play in the survival of life. Evan wrote in the project description, "The bionic turtle ability to autonomously track environmental changes with low ecological disruption and collect relevant information with minimal human intervention attests to the positive impact it can have on the health of our planet." This article, Teen's award-winning robot turtle could help underwater ecosystems thrive by detecting threats, was written by Stephanie Friedman. Our next article is by Joy Love. Estate sale surprise, Dolly painting could be found. The thrill of estate sales often lies in the unexpected treasures waiting to be discovered. Recently, an antiquities dealer who goes by the auction name of John Russell stumbled upon such a gem, a genuine Salvador Dali painting, at a London apartments estate sale. The painting, Vecchio Sultano, was one of the 100 illustrations Salvador Dali completed out of a 500-piece commission inspired by the Arabian Nights. Dali, known for his fascination with Moorish culture, was commissioned by the Italian couple Giuseppe and Mara Alboreto for his ambitious project, although it remained unfinished. Gabrielle Downey, a fine art specialist at an auction house in Cambridge, explained, "Dali was quite obsessed with the Moorish culture and believed himself to be from a Moorish line." Russell, who prides himself on his ability to spot genuine pieces, purchased the painting for a mere £150, driven by a hunch and years of experience watching a British television show about art authentication. He remarked, "Most of the time I buy stuff like that, or usually stuff like I like. On this occasion, however, I was really taking a bit of a punt because I wasn't sure I'd have it on the wall, to be honest. I do like some unusual art, but you'd have to love it, wouldn't you?" Upon closer inspection, Russell noted stickers on the back of the frame from a renowned auction house which hinted at the painting's authenticity. He later confirmed its origin by purchasing the auction catalog, which verified Vecchio Sultano as an original Dali. Now, this remarkable find is set to be auctioned at the Cambridge Auction House, where it's expected to fetch between $25,000 and $37,000. Now, that's a testament to the magic of estate sales. This discovery brings a forgotten Dali back in to the spotlight. This article, written by Joy Love, Estate Sale Surprise, Dali Painting Could Be Found. Learning disabilities don't equal low IQ. Dyslexia test places a 10-year-old girl in the top 1%. Learning disabilities don't equate to lower intelligence, and no one is proving that point more than a 10-year-old girl from Kent, England. After Poppy O'Malley Flack took a test for dyslexia because she'd been having trouble with spelling, she discovered she had an IQ of 136 and since has been invited to join the high IQ Society Mensa International. According to the BBC test, The Nation data from 2014, the average IQ in Britain is around 100, and any number above 135 puts you in the top 1%. Poppy was invited to take the three-hour exam, which also determined that she has exceptional reasoning and problem-solving skills ahead of her 11+, a British test many students take in their last year of elementary school. The news came as a surprise to Poppy's mom, 44-year-old Lucy O'Malley Flack, who told us that her daughter had always excelled in a creative subject like art. "We never expected to come out of dyslexic tests, and the lady saying her reasoning skills and intelligence were exceptionally high. We were as shocked, I think, as Poppy was," O'Malley Flack said, adding, "She had never been the type of child you thought was gifted or very academic, who goes up to their room and studies and loves learning. She is creative, and she's very good at art. However, she is very logical and has good reasoning skills and is a very good problem solver. We have always known that." She continued, "We always knew she was quite grown up for her age. It is a perfect example of how a learning difference and giftedness can coexist. While she might have struggled with spelling, she has extraordinarily good reasoning skill. Dyslexia is seen as something you have when you aren't intelligent, but that's not the case. She's actually very intelligent, and she struggles with certain aspects. After learning of Poppy's IQ, O'Malley Flack, who's an assistant principal at a local college, approached Mensah in the hopes of getting her daughter into the program with other gifted children. And shortly after her test results were sent off, Poppy received an email accepting her into the prestigious club. She joins the ranks of Gina Davis, Steve Martin, and a 3-year-old Mensah member, Joseph Harris Bertil, the society's youngest inductee. When the results said that she was in the top 1%, I joked that she should be a part of Mensah, shared O'Malley Flack. Then when I looked into it, they said I could send through the evidence. We were absolutely chuffed and really proud of her, and I think she was really proud of herself. It was a shock. It is the prestige that you are part of such a high intelligence group. But to her mom, Poppy is just a normal kid when it comes down to it. She is the most humble child you will ever meet, but she's really enjoying this prestige. The youngster now has plenty of Mensah merchandise, including a hoodie, mug, and a certificate, which O'Malley Flack said she is very proud of. This article, Learning Disabilities Don't Equal Low IQ, Dyslexia Test Places 10-Year-Old Girl in the Top 1%. And now we're coming to the end of our program today, so I'd like to leave you with this quote of the day. It's been my experience that you can nearly always enjoy things if you make up your mind firmly that you will. So said Lucy Maud Montgomery in Anne of Green Gables. I hope you enjoyed today's articles. Please join us again next time when we cover some new topics on Nice News. This has been Joyce Vesper, your volunteer broadcaster for Sun Sounds of Arizona, a radio reading service. Stay healthy, everyone. Be well. Be happy. Bye-bye.